Welcome to the Demimon Podcast, an unofficial podcast covering the Showtime series Penny Dreadful. For joining us today, we are No Ship Network. I am your host, Em.
And I am your host, Steve.
If you want to join our discussion, you can reach us by visiting our website at noship.net. Click anywhere it says contact, and it will direct you to various means you can use to reach us. Right now, if you want to write us an email, please use our noshipnetwork@gmail.com. Don't bother with the feedback section because it's not working, and I am currently working on that, and I'm sorry if anybody's tried to reach us that way. I have things to figure out with that. Okay, so also, if you would like to support us, one way is to do your Amazon shopping by clicking on our Amazon affiliate links located on our website. It does not cost you any extra, and what happens is Amazon gives us a percentage of anything you purchase through them. And another way is to rate and or review us on iTunes. This is actually the best way to support us. Thank you. We actually got a review recently by the Lady Door. It was very nice to see that. It made my Monday morning, made my week.
We are very appreciative of that. Thank you.
Thank you, the Lady Door. And also, you can share our links on your preferred social networking sites. After this recap, we will actually be featuring some feedback, so stay tuned for that. And we're going to go ahead and get right into recap now. So, Season 1, Episode 4, The Demimonde. Episode, of course, is written by John Logan. And this is directed by the same director from last episode, and the correct pronunciation is actually Dervla Walsh. I looked up how to pronounce her name on the internet. Okay, so Dervla Walsh is the director. The episode opens with a sex smorgasbord. It is at Dorian Gray's place, this orgy. He sits amidst the flesh, bored and disinterested. And I think I would have been pretty bored myself. That was a pretty boring orgy, in my opinion. I mean, I don't know what an exciting orgy looks like, but I think I would have been like, I'm leaving.
Did it really technically qualify as an orgy, though?
What else would you call it?
I don't know what else to call it. I'm not saying I know what it was, but it didn't look like, you know, not that I've ever been to one, but I mean, you see theatrical, you know, depictions of them, and it just didn't seem, I don't know, it seemed more like some weird, it reminded me of Spartacus a little bit.
Yeah.
It's something you would see in Spartacus where you've got, you know, of course, all the people standing there with the
A sexual anatomy. Menagerie.
Yeah, menagerie, you know, all the anatomy hanging out, they would have been house slaves, but, and these people are just there to partake in the party. But we learn very quickly of Dorian Gray's bisexuality.
Yes. And he's disinterested by what's going on, and his attention turns to the portraits on his wall, and there's one his eyes kind of pass over. She looked a little bit like Vanessa Ives, I thought.
You know what was interesting about this scene? A lot of stuff was interesting about this scene, even though I agree, it did seem boring at the same time. Visually, it was nice, but
very
quiet. It was surreal almost.
Yeah.
But this guy that's sitting next to him is pretty much obviously going down on him, you know, and because he begins the descent, so to speak. And Gray is looking up at the portraits, and at some point, you know, as the viewer, what's going on beneath the screen level,
right?
What you can see, but there's no indication of that on Dorian Gray's face.
No.
And it seems to be like a trope that they use a lot in pretty much any kind of TV show or movie, when you're just seeing the person's face, but somebody is, you know, going
doing
down.
Doing the BJ.
Yeah, doing the whatever you want to call it, the oral sex, what have you. You see that look on their face when the moment that it happens, the kind of like catch.
Oh, yeah.
But they don't. He doesn't do that. There's no register or recognition of anything going on. And I wonder if it's because they just skip that, or because he's just so involved with, he's so bored with what's going on in front of him, but he's so interested in what's going on up there in the portrait.
There's a conversation later he has with Ethan that explains all that. It's just repetition now to him. He won that gambling. He got the 97,
yeah,
and it
yeah.
just doesn't have the impact on him anymore. So same thing goes for blowjobs, I guess.
So it makes you wonder why he's doing it.
I think he's trying to get that feeling.
Hmm.
You know, I think he that probably whatever was going on in that room was upping the ante of what he has done before in some sense, but it's probably just not doing it for him.
So it's kind of like when he talks to Ives later on in the episode and he says, I like to see something extraordinary every day. It's maybe a metaphor for him chasing the high.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. And later he walks his apartment after all have left. He seems moody. He grabs some candlelight and walks into a secret room behind a portrait. He passes a hall of mirrors first until he comes into a chamber. In the center of the chamber sits a structure. He unveils it and sits before it. We cannot see what he is looking at.
But we're to assume that this is his portrait.
Yes. I really wanted them to show it, but I don't really want to talk about it because I don't know
how far they're going to go with keeping it real.
I just don't want to spoil anybody.
Okay. Yeah, I understand that.
You know, I don't.
But I, like I said, you know, I admitted my ignorance about his whole story in the first episode. So, but even as much as I don't know, I mean, you know, there's a book called The Portrait of Dorian Gray. So I think one can safely assume that he was about to sit in front of his own portrait. And it's kept away from all the other ones in kind of like a secluded area.
And why do you think that is?
That I don't know. I can't speculate on that.
But I want to say he's not really the same as the character in the book. Like, I like this Dorian Gray. So that's the difference. So I'm curious as what we'll see on that picture, that portrait. Okay, so moving on. Vanessa Ives sits on an outdoor bench before a cathedral. A young girl asks, why does she not go in? And Vanessa learns that this girl's mother has passed away. The young girl talks of her mother not staying in the ground for long. And this concerns Ives, and she questions the girl about this. The girl meant her mum may go to heaven or hell, not what Ives feared, of course.
Yeah, Ives is thinking, you know, vampires, right, or whatever. Which I thought this was a real prim and proper conversation up until that point.
It was like a young Jane Eyre she was having a conversation with. So she reminded me of.
But then it almost turned it. I thought they were about to turn it into some sort of weird dream sequence or something like that. When she's like, they don't stay dead, do they? You know, and then the girl sprouts like bat wings or something.
She's being fucked with by some demon or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So after the girl departs, she sees Dorian leaving the cathedral. She follows him to a conservatory. And first we are met with a close-up shot of a bloom, and a spider is ascending its web toward the petal. We've seen a spider associated with Ives before, right? And I'm wondering if this is shown to coincide and support what Dorian Gray says regarding poisonous flowers and Miss Ives, and I do believe so, and I'll explain why in a minute. Or she makes her presence known to Dorian. He wants to show her something extraordinary. He is fascinated with the duplicity and hidden depths of flowers. He shows her a flowering plant and he wants to know what she thinks of it. She describes it as if the scent is seductive. He reveals that the plant is nightshade, and then he talks of the adder beneath a rose and dark things waiting. She said things are so rarely what they seem.
So what did you think the first time you saw this, and when he says duplicity, you know what I mean? It's like, that's a really odd way to describe a plant. I mean, that's a characteristic of you know, human personalities. Even she was kind of like, come again? You know, and he kind of had to explain himself. And what did you think?
I really, other than what he's already said, just talking about the beauty of something and then also having the dark side of it, it's poisonous. So there's something enamoring about it and seductive about it, but it will bite you, basically.
I mean, it fits at the end of the day, but at first it's just that, like, you know, for as many years as I've been alive, I've never heard anyone call a plant duplicitous.
So the extraordinary thing he actually wants to show her is a Rothschild slipper. This flower actually sells for $5,000 per stem on the black market, by the way. I looked it up.
Right now?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Jesus.
He talks of its rarity and how it takes 15 years to bloom, and at that all that time perfecting itself. She asks, is it poisonous? And he says, like all beautiful things, I hope so. They part. He tells her he will be at the theater. The scene ends with a close-up of Ives' face, and she is tormented by something. Is this more of what the initial shot of the bloom was trying to show us, the torment being whatever is associated with the spider? They bookended this scene between her and Dorian Gray beautifully, because you have the opening scene with that close-up of the flower with the spider, and they end it with a close-up of her face, and she has torment on her face.
So you think whatever her dark passenger is there's.
It's associated with her praying at that cross with whatever the spider is signifying and all that. Like whatever she's using to channel this dark shit in her life. Yeah.
Yeah, I can see that.
So next scene, we are in for a surprise. We have Van Helsing. We thought that Malcolm Murray was the Van Helsing, but there is an actual Van Helsing.
It's a nice little twist because we were kind of convinced because everybody had their archetype of who's who, you know, in the group. And we thought of Mr. M as the Van Helsing archetype. But apparently there's an actual Van Helsing here.
I'm wondering because I remember he was a professor in the book. And I remember like a scene where you're actually in his classroom, you know, where he's teaching, I believe. And but I don't remember specifically what he was teaching. I wonder if he was a hematologist in the book. I don't remember what his specific profession was. So I wonder if we should have known that. But anyway, so he's a hematologist and he's working with Victor, looking into blood samples. And as you would expect with Van Helsing, he has experience studying things of this nature. He has created this solution to allow the interdiction of the blood to be visible. Van Helsing named it for his wife, which he calls Hannah's Wink. I like that name. And the blood has a property which allows it to prevent coagulation, which aids blood eating, as Van Helsing says. And I'm guessing this aids by allowing the vampire to drink it quickly, maybe without its prey's body trying to start the healing process as it feeds, like a mosquito. Anyway, the fact that Van Helsing has this knowledge prompts Victor to shut out Sembene's prying ears outside the door. And Victor asks Van Helsing how well he knows Malcolm Murray and how well does he know about these creatures. Van Helsing says Malcolm Murray is looking for a cure towards something that he does not understand and that he himself understands it intimately, that Van Helsing understands vampirism.
So at this point, we haven't heard the word vampire. We haven't heard the word bloodsucker. No. And they've kind of made it a point to stay away from anything that's already been established on this because he doesn't say blood drinking. He says blood eating.
Yes, that's right. I wonder if it's like kind of Walking Dead where in their universe, nobody has ever heard of.
I think
of,
it's exactly like that.
Yeah. So they don't have literature to explain this stuff.
I think I'm just complimenting on them on doing a really good job of keeping with that. You know what I mean? So, and not going, okay, well, now we're going to call this thing a vampire all of a sudden, you know? Because, I mean, I think on Walking Dead, they don't even call them zombies at all.
No, they don't.
They just call them walkers or roamers or whatever.
Fighters,
yeah.
So, Victor, he then hears a horse and carriage arrival outside, and he looks out the window, and he sees Caliban lurking in a doorway. He excuses himself from Van Helsing's company. This leads to Victor confronting Caliban. Caliban is demanding for his mate. Victor says this is not easy and that he needs supplies. Caliban wants no excuses, only results. He wants his bride to be beautiful. And Victor says, like you, or something along those lines. This invokes Caliban's violent nature, and he slams Victor against a wall. He talks of the weakness of mortals and tells Victor to look upon his master. He then leaves Victor.
Now, there's something different about Caliban than there was with Proteus. Apparently, Caliban is immortal. Because he said this before.
Immortal?
Yeah, he's immortal. He's not going to die because he said, even if I could die, in the episode when he was revealed.
So you don't think somebody could do some violence to him the way that it was done to Proteus?
No, I don't believe that he could. Because he's even in doubt of his own ability to die. So, and he's super strong, but he went in there and he did what he did to Proteus. So there's a difference between the two. I think that Caliban was some sort of experiment where Proteus was the reanimation of a corpse. But I think that there's hints here, and this is just my, you know, like a prediction, I guess, that there's going to be some sort of uneasy truce or alliance formed between the group as we know it with Frankenstein in it and Caliban. And he's giving a reminder to the audience that he can kick some serious ass if he wants to, you know, because he's talking about the frailty of you mortals. So it's giving us a reminder that he's got this superhuman strength and he's not a mortal, and he's going to be enlisted to kind of be the muscle to fight some of these baddies that they're going to have to go up against.
You mentioned this last cast. I think you're really hoping for this.
Oh yeah, I am because you know, he's going to stick around. You see him in the credits now. So I just,
yeah,
I mentioned it last cast because there was kind of like a seed of an idea, but after this scene, I feel like they're really trying to telegraph that to us.
So you think after a while, maybe he won't be so hateful towards Victor?
I don't know if they're ever going to become like chums or anything like that, but I think they might find some sort of common ground to work from, you know, and then Victor can kind of extend his usefulness to Caliban, and then they can work together and be like, look, if you want me to do things A, B, and C for you, or just this one A thing that you're always wanting with the immortal mate, who now has to also be beautiful, you know, talk about upping the ante, but you're going to have to do this for me because no one else is going to be able to do what I can do for you.
So Ethan and Brona lay in a bed cuddling. She talks of a past betrothal. He was a brutal man with brutal hands. This led to her first act of prostitution. And then Ethan talks of having sins at his back that will kill him if he were to turn and look. He tells her he has taken her out tonight and to look her best. He says he is off to work, and then she tells him to be careful. I really truncated that scene, but any comments on that?
It's sad the way she's telling that story about everything and how she went to her mom and was like, this guy's hurting me. And she was like, just get married. I don't want to have to support you anymore. But I guess that reflects the harsh reality of those times.
Yeah, especially being female. A lot of the books I've read in Victorian times seem to center around people of certain means. They have more money, and like women inherit like a salary, or it's not really a salary, I forget what they call it, but they have like so much a year.
A stipend.
And so, of course, they can pick and choose their husbands a little bit more carefully. And so Ethan, Victor, and Sembeni and Malcolm Murray are with their captured thrall. Fenton, the captured thrall, wants Vanessa. He wants Mother. Malcolm Murray asks, why do you want Vanessa? And he responds, why doesn't anyone want her? So nurturing, isn't she, Sir Malcolm? I think he says, this is where he says Sir M.
Yes.
This disturbs Malcolm Murray for some reason. Victor and Ethan force the thrall down, and Victor injects him with a sedative. The thrall curses them all, especially Malcolm Murray. He then says he does not want to sleep, and Malcolm Murray asks, why not? The thrall looks at them all individually and then says, so many monsters. He was referring to them, or he's referring to what he was going to...
It's a double entendre. Yeah. He's referring to them, but, firstly, he's referring to, as an obvious reference, the monsters in his head. You know, I mean, being a thrall, I mean, you've got this master you've got to serve. You've probably gone through this hellish process to get there, you know, so there's monsters enough there, but then he's looking at all of them, and he can probably see the darkness in all of them, and it's just so many monsters.
So after the thrall is asleep, Victor tells Ethan to roll up his sleeve. Ethan says it's not a good idea. Malcolm Murray offers himself in his stead.
What I liked about this scene is we're still getting this drawn out thing about, is he a werewolf? Is he not? Is he something other than that? Because we don't definitely know he's a werewolf, but we're leaning in that direction. But he's something other than just simply human. And he kind of says, look, you really don't want to get the blood out of me. This is not going to be good. You know, give the blood of whatever have you to the blood of a vampire thrall, and it's going to be bad news. What I liked about this is Frankenstein's like, it won't hurt, you know? And then when Murray just, you know, volunteers for it, he's like, I lied. It's going to hurt a little bit. They're just so snarky with each other.
He wanted to hurt Ethan. Make him jump. So later in Malcolm Murray's study, they talk of the mutilations that's in the newspaper, the recent crimes. This is specifically Victor and Malcolm Murray discussing it. And this arouses Ethan's temper. Victor and Ethan have another row. Malcolm Murray interrupts them and talks of the Nile. He talks of world renown awaiting him, which is all of a sudden, this is where Malcolm Murray, this must be his dark side, right? Because this whole Africa thing being like such a temptation for him, because there's shit going on right now that has to do with his daughter. And all of a sudden he's like, let's go to Africa. Unless it has something to do with what they're doing.
It's got to. There's got to be something that he's a step ahead of everybody else, or a couple of steps ahead of everybody else. And he's not filling in everybody else on his plans. And he has respect for other people who don't want to do that, because he says, you know, Miss Ives will fill you in as far as she feels and, you know, a need to.
Right.
Whenever he's, you know, she's talking to Ethan. But I don't know if he lets her extend that courtesy to him, or how it works between the two of them, but...
Well, I'm going to finish this recap part of the scene, and then we'll come back to that, because...
Okay.
Anyway, so he asks Ethan if he would like to join Malcolm Murray himself in Africa, and Ethan asks, is there not enough danger for you here? At this point, Vanessa walks in, and she asks, what are they up to? Why are they so solemn? And the discussion about Africa is alluded to, and she says, oh, that. This upsets Malcolm Murray, and he asks, why does she always have to denigrate his work? She says, because he never really ever goes, and that he should just leave it to the youth. And Victor says, no, not me. I am bloodless. And she says to him, that is part of his appeal. Then Malcolm Murray says to Ives, you've had a long day. And she says she went to look at something beautiful. She's talking about Dorian, by the way, there. If it has anything to do with Mina, why would she denigrate it?
What if she doesn't know it has anything to do with Mina?
She's right. He does keep things from her.
Amun-Ra and Amunet, those are Egyptian names.
Yeah, you're right. Egypt, and he is talking about the Nile.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's...
He probably doesn't want her to know about that. Because it's been alluded to that she's somehow related to Amunet multiple
times.
Well,
you know, and Zidler said, who wants to know the devil's chasing you?
Right.
So, I mean, he's playing it pretty straight. He's just, he has plans. I mean, he's the mastermind behind all this. He has plans that he doesn't have to let everybody know. He's like the Professor X of this group. You know, he'll let you in on it when he's ready to let you in on it. And he's not ready.
So, next scene, Fenton is awake. It at first seems he is more docile. Because he's pretending. And Ives tosses him an apple when he says he's hungry. He feigns interest and then turns violent. He wants blood and flesh. Victor says it will be a process regarding the treatment. And then Ethan says to get him something to eat. Later, Ethan and Ives talk of Ethan's disturbance regarding everyone's behavior towards Fenton. He wants to know how far they will go, and she cannot answer him. And she bids him a good evening and starts to walk back to the others, and then she changes her mind and heads upstairs. I think she's going to change because she decided to go to the theater.
Mm.
So Victor and Malcolm Murray talk of what they could possibly feed this thrall when Sembene, who finally gets some character development as a cat killer, walks up with a cat, wrings its neck, and tosses it thrall.
He did give it that small mercy of killing it first, so it wasn't eaten alive by a Renfield.
I bet it was a cat that he just hated that was just hanging around the property.
In the courtyard,
yeah.
Out front, that was always meowing really loud at night.
Yeah.
Give me some treats. Give me some treats. Yeah. In cat. They say it in cat.
We know how to speak cat. I speak cat very well. So next, at the Grand Guignol, Ethan and Brona get their seats. He buys her an orange. Caliban prepares the stage, and this was a surprise for Rona, and she was really excited to be there and everything. It was really cool that he did that for her. So Caliban prepares the stage. Dorian Gray and Ives are also in attendance. Rona is taken with the performance, and the torture features a werewolf, which does not seem to disturb Ethan at all. And Rona keeps sticking her fingers in her mouth, and it's no wonder she has TB. So we'll just move on from that.
This was all before people could go and study microbiology out of college.
So Victor and Malcolm Murray are in Malcolm Murray's study. Victor asks if Ives was right about Africa. Okay, Victor is jealous of Ethan being asked to go to Africa instead of himself. Malcolm Murray says he has lost a son in Africa and that Ethan is only a finger on a trigger, and Victor is more than that to Malcolm Murray. So could it have been a boy child that was at the seance that...
It's possible, yeah. But I mean, the picture that, you know, he had was like
a boy and a girl.
A boy and a girl. So I think
the girl
maybe,
could be Mina and the boy could be his son.
Yeah. Assuming that he only had two kids.
Right. There's only two kids in the picture.
Right. Who knows? I don't know. It could be, yeah. Because they didn't state the gender of the kid who was dying of the dysentery, did they?
No.
Yeah.
I don't think so. I think you just assume it's female because it's being channeled through a female.
Right, right. I thought this was a tender moment between the two of them because Frankenstein's looking at him as a father figure / mentor and stuff. And, you know, he was jealous. And he didn't even deny it. He was just like, well, you know, people of my disposition like to be known as, you know, or looked at as capable every now and then. You know, which is understandable because it's just the way of the world. But, you know, so there's a little bit of jealousy, but I think Malcolm lays it to rest pretty deftly.
I think he's being unfair to Ethan, though, just calling him a finger on a trigger.
Well, you know, they've also kind of had their differences, you know what I mean? Because Ethan's the one who's been fighting them every time they want to try to do something else to Fenton.
Yeah,
You
and
know
he
what I
swore
mean?
his fealty to Ives, not to
Exactly. So
Malcolm Murray.
he's not in that Burns family circle of trust quite yet, all the way. Whereas Victor is, you know, because Victor's like all in already. Where with Ethan, there's just a little. Plus, he's an American, and I don't know. There's a couple of strikes against him in the group. He's definitely the odd person out in the group at this point.
So Fenton has a visitor, and then he begins to gnaw on his wrist.
So he's basically, I looked at it the second time I watched a lot closer. He's gnawing on his wrist above where the cuff is because he's trying to slick his wrists with blood so he can, you know, pull off the chains.
Yeah,
the
I expected
chains.
To see hands off on the ground, like, you know, a stump. Like, but he
oh, yeah.
obviously had hands later.
Didn't go
but,
that far.
But that's what I thought was happening the first time I watched it. The werewolf story continues on the stage of the Grand Guignol. The werewolf slays his victim. This frightens Brona, but it cracks Ethan up. I don't know what that says about Ethan, because I'm convinced he's a werewolf.
Well, he's probably, if he is a werewolf, he's probably laughing because he's like, it's really nothing like this.
Yeah.
You know?
He's also an actor, though. So.
Yeah, he could just be appreciating the craft.
Yeah, exactly. And some Benny's there, spying on Ives, it looks like.
And I think it's a few scenes later or a scene later that whenever, well, I can get to
everybody
that.
Departs except Ives. Is that what you mean?
Well, everybody's gone from the house when they hear Captain Howdy upstairs or downstairs or whatever. And Victor asks
Oh, he says
Malcolm,
Sembene had the night off.
Sembene has the night off. He doesn't have the night off. Or if he does, if he's technically off, quote unquote, he's spending his time making sure that she's okay.
I doubt he has the night off. Because they went into intermission for the play. So now we are back with Victor and Malcolm Murray. They hear something in the house upstairs. They go to investigate. They are being followed by Fenton. He's crawling up the stairs creepily. Malcolm Murray and Victor trace the sound to Ives' room. They discover a master vampire in her bedroom. And the vampire flees from the cross. And Malcolm Murray and Victor are attacked by Fenton. This is where Victor proves that he's not very capable. As far as, like, his physical ability, because he didn't really help out very much.
Yeah, he could have at least took a swing or something.
Something.
You know, pulled his hair, maybe.
Malcolm Murray took charge, though, and Fenton is tossed off Malcolm Murray's back, and he lands on some glass shards that impale the back of his skull, killing him. And he as he dies, he says, mother. I don't, you know, he's in her bedroom. He says, mother. He calls her mother. I'm talking about Ives. I don't,
right.
You know.
Are you thinking that she's Fenton's mom?
No, I'm not. I'm thinking that whatever... I still hold to the idea that there's some sort of thing in her that she has purposely carried around to help with this investigation, let's say. That's my theory at this point. And whatever that thing is she's already said it's something old at the seance, not Aminette. She denied being Aminette. Maybe she's the mother of vampires. Something, you know, which usually in a lot of lore is like Lilith. So, not just True Blood. So, that's just...
Throwing it out there.
That's my theory.
Okay,
so,
all right.
There's got to be something to that.
I don't have one to compete with it, so...
Okay. So, at intermission, Ethan introduces Brona to Ives. Dorian approaches then, and he's introduced to Ethan. Brona tries to act like she does not know Dorian.
Awkward.
Yeah. And Ives talks of Ethan's acting abilities. Brona then leaves in a huff. Ethan chases after her out into the streets. She is shamed and angry, and she yells at Ethan and tells him that their relationship will amount to nothing because of her illness. She said next time he wants to fuck her, he will have to pay her, and she leaves him. Dorian approaches him and offers to take Ethan away from himself. Ethan leaves when there is promise of drink and no Ives.
Now, part of the reason that she was The biggest part of the reason that she was in a huff was because Dorian showed up. And she's like, okay, this guy I'm screwing now is friends with the guy that I was just screwing a week ago. So who knows what's running through her head, you know?
She was already uncomfortable before that when she was introduced to Vanessa Ives. She was very uncomfortable.
Well, hold on, let me finish. Now, that's the thing that made her the most uncomfortable, I think, is the fact that Dorian Gray was there. But you're right. She was uncomfortable because of Vanessa Ives, but she was also uncomfortable because of this, like, the way that all three of these people were able to talk to each other, whether it was inside references or talking about rhetorical flourish or this or that. And there was a very class warfare element going on here. because she's obviously just a like a street urchin type. You know, she came from the country to be the lowest dregs of the city, and here you've got these people from.
She felt inferior.
Yeah, very inferior. What could you got these people who could be described as like upper class or what have you? You know, just a couple of steps down from royalty as
educated
far as
elite.
Yeah, and she just feels like really, really out of place, and that's a real thing. I think her reaction was a little bit over the top, but.
Yeah.
It probably serves the purpose of the story, but I mean, I just couldn't see somebody reacting that way so violently unless she thought that there was some sort of something to where Dorian had talked to Ethan and been like, hey, I'm banging this really, great hooker over here if you want to get a chance or something like that. Yeah, I don't know. I'm reaching here, but I'm trying to kind of get a feel for why she would have such a visceral reaction to something like that.
I know. I bought her reacting like that. Actually,
don't get me wrong. I'm not saying it was bad acting, and
no,
I'm not saying
no.
It was a bad scene. What I'm trying to say is,
I'm saying it's realistic what she did.
I feel like I was left a little bit like it was a an unequal reaction to what was actually going on.
Yeah. Well, I think she. You know, when you are afraid to admit what's really bothering you, like I feel inferior.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of channel it somewhere else, and it comes out crazy.
Okay, yeah, I mean, I guess I can see that.
So, Ives goes back to her seat to see that Dorian is gone, and Senbene is still watching Ives. Even though everybody else is gone, he's still there watching her. So he was definitely sent, I think, to watch her specifically.
Why would Malcolm say that to Victor? Why would he say Senbene has the night off?
Because
why wouldn't he say
he sent him? He probably doesn't want Victor to worry that he would ever have Senbene follow him. I mean, that's his prerogative to use Senbene in that way. That's his man. And he wants to keep tabs on the people that are working for him. He mentioned earlier that, Ives, you had a long day. What the hell were you doing all day? He's curious.
I didn't see it as him keeping tabs on her. He already knew she was going to the show, and that's where she was at, to
he
the
knew
theater.
That?
Yeah, because he said she's out to the theater.
Okay.
Did he just say that she's out?
I don't remember.
I think he sent him there, if he did send him there in the first place, which I don't know if I believe that. I think he might have went on his own because he knows strange things are going on. But if he did send him, I think he sent him without her knowledge for protection, just to make sure.
That's better. That's more charitable. I like that better.
Well, yeah, I think it's either that or else he did it of his own volition because he knew that, it's dangerous times in
yeah,
London.
Yeah, I like that better. I'm going to...
We'll go
glom onto yours now. Okay.
All right. You're welcome.
Okay. So when we see Brona, she's having a bloody coughing fit in the streets. I felt really bad for her.
Somebody get this girl a doctor.
Where's David Tennant when you need him? Dorian takes Ethan to someplace that is not completely legal, a gambling pit involving dogs and rats. And this is called rat baiting. Rat baiting is a blood sport which involves placing rats in a pit or other enclosed areas and then betting on how long it takes a dog, usually a terrier, to kill them. It is now legal in most countries, but was popular sport until the beginning of the 20th century. The last public competition took place in Leicester in 1912. The owner was prosecuted, fined, and had to give a promise to the court that he could never again promote such entertainment. Toward the latter half of Queen Victoria's reign, a more humane attitude toward canines gradually emerged, the Queen's love of animals setting the example. Baiting sports diminished in popularity, and the exhibition of dogs slowly replaced the attractions of the dog pit.
Interesting. So, it's called rat baiting? From what I understood
yes.
of it, like you start off at the bottom, then you become intermediate, and then eventually you become a master baiter. And you...
I was wondering where you were going with that.
On to the next.
So Ethan is unable to tolerate watching this activity and heads back to the bar only to be harassed by some men. And he ends up losing his temper, understandably. And I had asked you while we were watching this if this is realistic, did men carry on like that, being jerks in
yeah,
such
yeah.
a way? Okay.
It's true. Well, I got two things to say about this scene, or at least two things to say about the scene. First of all, it was a reversal. It was kind of cool because first you had a dog killing a bunch, on top of a bunch of rats, just dominating them. And then you had the scene reversed and you had one dog with a bunch of rats on top of him,
being Ethan being the dog.
Right. Ethan being the dog and those guys being the rats. Cause yeah, they were being pieces of shit. I mean, Have I witnessed behavior like that firsthand? Not exactly like that, but I've definitely seen a group of guys push around one or two other guys who they know they could take because you've got a combination of liquid courage and then you've got the strength in numbers, and everybody feels more brave when their friends are around.
And they got to prove themselves in front of their friends too.
Exactly. It's almost like the English version of frat boys,
Yeah.
you know, the classic movie asshole frat boys. And so does that kind of thing happen all the time in bars? I don't know, but I mean, people are always getting in bar fights, so it's got to be over something. But I thought it was a pretty good scene because the guy who kept poking him in the head, man, he got his ass
Thank
kicked.
goodness. I was like, yes, when he slammed his tumbler into his face.
Yeah. And some people, that's the only way you can teach him anything. You know what I mean? He'll probably never push anybody's, push his finger into anybody's temple anymore.
I doubt it.
But.
Back at Dorian's, Ethan is cleaning up after the fight. Ethan asks Dorian about his colognes.
Well, he's got quite a collection. I
Yeah.
mean, he's got more colognes than a woman has perfume.
They have some absinthe. And they toast over the most mysterious thing in London, Miss Vanessa Ives.
Absinthe, yeah. We've actually had absinthe before.
We've had the real
The
stuff.
real stuff. I had a coworker who had went to the Czech Republic on vacation, and she was kind enough to bring back a bottle of the real stuff for us. I mean, as real as it gets. I understand that the recipe these days is different than it was in Victorian times, but we had to do the same thing. You put it in a shot glass, and then you well, actually, you put a sugar cube in a little, what do you call it?
A lace spoon.
Yeah, like a lace spoon, and then you poured the shot over that.
Ice cold water over that into
Yeah.
the absinthe. It's
And
been years, so you don't remember the
it is really
details.
strong. I remember the sugar cube. That's the important
You
part.
probably don't remember most of the night
No, I
either.
don't remember most of the night. And that's the interesting thing about absinthe. I mean, I'm not a big drinker anyway, so I don't have blackouts or anything like that. But this is the only time I've ever had a night of drinking where there's gaps in my memory.
Lot of fun that night. Okay. Ives returns home. She knows instantly something has happened. Montgomery tells her it was here. He tells that Fenton is dead and that it was in her room looking for her. And he also says that it was all a ploy to allow the master to find Vanessa. So the whole plan of her finding Fenton at the zoo was not a weak sauce plan. It was actually for them to bring Fenton to the house so the master could find their home base, basically. Vanessa says that Mina is manipulating her because Mina is the one who sent her to the zoo
Right.
for this all to take place. And Ives and Malcolm-Murray argue over Mina and who has hurt Mina more. Malcolm-Murray says that Ives is the daughter that Malcolm-Murray deserves. And then he says that they will carry on, that they can lose every battle except the last. So I don't think this means that she's his daughter.
I agree. I don't think it means that either.
I think she's. Judging by the next time on, which we don't ever see, this is the first time we ever saw next time on, but I think she was a very close friend to Mina. So that's my guess. So now we're back with Ethan and Dorian, and Ethan asks Dorian if he has a favorite portrait. And Dorian says he does, but it is not in that room. Ethan talks of Indian tribal art of animals that he favors. There's no people, just animals and the sun and the moon.
He feels like it's more, at first he says primitive, and then he changes his assessment to honest.
Yeah, and that's like how he described Brona. And I think that's also why he gave his fealty to Ives, because she finally opened up to him about her abilities, and so he appreciated that about her, somebody being honest with him, not holding back too much. And so I think that's what he likes. And Dorian Gray is, I think, definitely probably the most honest person in the show.
Oh yeah, there's probably some TMI from his side. You know what I mean? So.
So we find out pretty quickly that he really likes Dorian. But first they talk of music, and Dorian specifically saying that music's honest and it's ephemeral and it's like a phantasm. He plays Wagner, and Ethan listens to the music, and recent events play in his mind. And some of these things that he sees in his mind, could he possibly have an image of, like the brutalized bodies? Was it because they're from the newspaper, or was it because he was there? Like, is he the killer?
See that's a good point. I don't know if that's what they're trying to tell us, because everything else besides those brutalized bodies or mutilated bodies is something that happened to him that we've seen happen to him. But they show the girl at the bench getting killed, and then you see the lady who's
See,
looking at
yeah.
him and everything. So I think they are trying to tell us that whenever he reverts to whatever he is, a werewolf or something other, he is the one that's committing these crimes, and he's unaware of it when he's doing it. He's not in control.
But he must have some awareness if he's having this play across his mind here.
He has the memory of it when it's done.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean he has any kind of...
control while it's happening.
Yeah.
So then he walks over to Dorian and grabs him by the throat and kisses him. They begin addressing each other and kissing. And end of episode.
Thought, before... I have something to say about that, too. But you think instead of being a werewolf, he could be... He's not a doctor, but he could be Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
He could be, because they're similar. I mean, actually...
I just threw it out there. It just occurred to me that, you know, because we're dealing with a lot of these horror tropes from this time.
Yeah.
I don't know. But then there's also the American Werewolf in London.
I don't think he's Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, because okay. I think his persona that's not the transformed persona would be a lot weaker. Like Ethan himself, he wouldn't be this strong man.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. It's probably not. But well, yeah, the way I read this scene is really cool, because he gets up to play his cylinder and he says, I'd ask you if you've heard of Wagner, but you just pretend like you haven't. You know, they keep alluding to his hidden depths in one way or another, you know, that he's a complicated person who's trying to pretend like he's this kind of Western frontiersman, straight-laced, no-nonsense American guy, you know, which... I think in the British mind at that time was this unnuanced, uncomplicated
sure.
sort of just, I'm going to shoot you to solve all
you
the problems.
I think just at that time, I think even now, but.
Okay, you're right. Yeah, let's be fair. They probably think about us that way now.
Yeah.
Yeah, we all wear cowboy hats and eat steaks every night and ride horses to work.
And drink out of solo cups.
Yeah, we drink out of big solo cups. If we're not riding our horses, we're driving our Hummers. But I liked this scene a lot, because when he's playing the music and he's having all these images flash through his head, when he started walking fast, I thought he was making his exit. Like he had to get out and get some fresh air. And then he walks over to Dorian and grabs him like he's going to choke him. And then he kisses him, you know, and I didn't think that there was any shock value in this at all, which I thought was good. You know, they didn't play it for that.
Yeah.
It was just a straight up scene, but it was also indicative of their personalities and the way that they do things, because Ethan tears his clothes off. He's just really like harsh and rude about it. And then Dorian, as he, you know, like he slowly unbuttons and then just gently pulls it off. So they each have their own way of doing things. One is very rough and rugged and one is very meticulous. And
yeah.
They're sharing that between the two of them. And I thought it was kind of sweet.
One thing I like about Dorian is that he it's fun for him to be around Ives and Ethan, because he knows they're both hiding their true natures, but he is like very keen on what their true nature is. And it's like a game to him, but he's honest about it too. You know, he's not mean about it. He's playful about it. And I think with him slowly uncovering his, like taking off his shirt, is kind of like in the same way as he's slowly revealing their true nature.
I didn't think of that. That's good.
Yeah.
It's really good.
I really like Dorian Gray. I don't want to talk about the book too much, but
we don't have
it's
to.
It's
he's grown on me. At first, I didn't like him. The first episode that he was in, or you know, I didn't care for him too much.
But, too much of a pretty boy for you?
No, it's not that he was a pretty boy. I just didn't feel like I got enough of his character to really like him or dislike him. So I guess I didn't necessarily dislike him. A better way to describe it would be I was just ambivalent towards him. I was like, I'm, you know, don't care for this character too much because I haven't seen enough. The whole prettiness thing, it's...
He's very pretty. I'm not surprised she's following him.
A lot of guys are bothered by pretty boys, which I don't understand. I mean, unless you think they're pretty and you have some sort of conflicting feelings about that that you need to deal with, but I don't, you know.
So any thoughts, further thoughts on this episode before we move into feedback?
No, I think we covered it all.
All right. Well, I'm looking forward to next episode. I can't wait to watch it. All right. So we're going to move into the feedback section. Okay. We've got some feedback from one of our favorite listeners who's been listening to us since our Vikings podcast from The Wild Hunt, actually. We affectionately refer to him as Hot Tub, but his name is Mike Spa.
What's up, Hot Tub?
Hot Tub, it's full of water. Wait, how does it go?
Are you talking about when Eddie Murphy does...
Hot Tub.
He's doing James Brown on Saturday Night Live.
You guys should look it up. It's great.
Full of water.
That's your theme song, Mike Spa, just so you know. So I don't want to say the first part because there's something where he mentions he's been spoiled on, and all I'm going to say is that I've been spoiled on that too recently.
But I haven't, so for my protection and yours, we're going to...
I'm not going to say it, but Mike Spahn knows what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter. Anyway, so I'm going to go into the next part. So he's talking about episode 3, the last one we covered, right? He says, it's at this point that I need to tell y'all that I am not a fan of horror, but don't hate it either. I am not big on werewolves or vampire shows, movies. However, who didn't like Silver Bullet? Gary Busey and Corey Haim at their finest. I have read most of Anne Rice's vampires novels, so I am familiar with vampires and can enjoy them. There were some parts that I really felt lacking and ruined the good parts. The scene in the zoo where the group was surrounded by the wolves was stupid and not needed. The only thing it did was drop another hint that Ethan was a werewolf. But they have done such a better job in other parts of the show that this was not needed at all. The wolf lightly biting Ethan's hand was just plain stupid. The scene with Ethan and Brona having sexy time and Ethan kiss Brona on the lips, knowing she has consumption, did a much better job of hint dropping. The next scene that really put me off was the scene where the group was bickering and not necessarily together in the fight. When Sir Malcolm demanded that everyone be in 100% and give testament, felt like a Scooby-Doo movie. Everyone swearing fealty was also just dumb. This episode had me pretty bummed out, but not put off. The characters are great, and the secrets definitely leave me wanting for more and very intrigued. I hope Showtime steps up their game and stops writing for the stupid. Isn't that what TV is for? I enjoy your podcasts as always. They are insightful and fun. I wish I could sit with y'all and be a part of the fun. P.S. Episode 4 was fantastic. The writer's past transgressions are absolved. So he likes this episode and made up for it. So, okay. So any comments on his points about episode 3?
I guess there is some merit to the whole zoo thing. I didn't feel like that was the strongest point of that episode by far. I didn't feel like the scene with the wolves was stupid. I liked it, but I just did the whole zoo thing. I mean, everything that happened in that scene could have happened in some other way and not really affected the episode, you know, too badly. But I just don't think – I don't have, you know, Hot Tub's visceral reaction to that. But I think it's cool that he likes the show despite not really being a horror fan, and I think it speaks to the strength of the show that people who really aren't into horror all that much can enjoy it.
Well, I think I can say something that might make that scene better as far as, like, the wolf lightly biting Ethan's hand, as he mentioned. I think because I had mentioned the story of Tyr and Fenrir, which mm-hmm. Fenrir is a wolf in the Norse mythology, and Tyr had to stick his hand into Fenrir's mouth. And it was actually a sign of trust, because that was the way that Fenrir could trust them. And they ended up, you know, betraying Fenrir, and that's why he bites Tyr's hand off. But anyway, I think, you know, even though most people don't have that knowledge, it does enrich it a little bit to show that this is an old custom that is as old as the Norse gods, that is among these werewolf or wolf-like kin or whatever yeah. you want to call them. I definitely believe Ethan's a wolf something. He could be like Elias Makara from Wheel of Time.
Yeah.
Who knows? Be better if he had yellow eyes. But so hopefully that makes it better. When I first watched it, I kind of had this like sense of unease about it in the way that it's like a silliness type of unease, because the CGI is just not where it needs to be to make that look realistic.
Yeah, that was a sticking point. I didn't mention it when we covered the episode originally, but there is a little bit of, I guess for lack of a better term, lackluster CGI in that particular scene. You can tell that you're seeing CGI. But they've done such a great job with effects other places in that episode and the whole series. And I think they're doing a lot of actual effects, though. I don't think this show relies too heavily on CGI, at least not so far. So maybe that's why it stood out, because you're not getting a lot of CGI in the first place. And then when you do, it kind of sticks out like that sore thumb.
Yeah, it's like your brain has a hiccup when you're watching it, and you're just like, I don't like that.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
So any thoughts on what he was talking about regarding the Scooby-Doo scene with them bickering?
I didn't have a problem with that scene. I thought it was a necessary scene to get them all on the same page. They all had to realize, you know, it was a way, it was either that or have it be drawn out for the next 3 or 4 episodes. Like, who has a problem with this and who has a problem with that? There had to be one guy in charge, and he had to lay down the law and say, everybody's going to be on the same page with this. Let's go forward. And I think they did a good job of doing that.
I think it kind of defines some sort of tension, because you now have this or uneasy alliance that has just been formed.
Yeah.
So, you know, something could just go awry, you know, at some point. Somebody could betray
disturb
them
somehow,
or, yeah, disturb it in some way. So, it's kind of subtle. But
you're right, because you've got Victor, who is really throwing in his lot with Murray, and then you've got Ethan, who's really only giving his fealty to Ives.
Right.
And Gray is no part of this yet, you know, which I'm assuming he's going to need to be at some point,
yeah,
or he probably will.
I'm not sure what kind of use he would be.
Yeah, we don't know in what capacity he could work, but he's definitely part of the show, and he's here to stay.
He's almost like a distraction for Ives, in a way.
Hmm. Well, he's a distraction for Ethan at the end of this episode, for sure.
That's true.
There's going to be some, that's going to cause a rift between the two of them, you know, because it's like, that's my man. No, that's my man. Or maybe they'll just share. Who knows? I mean, it's...
Might share.
It's showtime, right?
So, last thing I want to do is just go over consumption, because we haven't really talked about it, and that's what Brona has.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a disease that is caused, is also known as tuberculosis, and it's widespread and in many cases fatal, and it's highly infectious. You know, at the time, I think they were just unaware of how it was infectious, like how you could transfer it, and she's more worried about people kissing her on the lips,
right,
especially if there's blood on her lips. But
it's an airborne disease,
it
though,
is
so
airborne.
They wouldn't need to do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and it can actually stay suspended in aerosols for a long time, you know, so it's even, that is like the one thing that can actually get through a mask that a doctor wears.
Is tuberculosis?
Yes.
Wow.
I think those masks can pretty much, I mean, there's probably some masks that could possibly, you know, filter that out. But for the most part, most like health professional masks, that is the one bacterium that can get through there.
Hmm.
Also, this part was interesting. I mean, there's a lot I could say about it, but I thought this was the best part, just in relation to the show. Before the Industrial Revolution, folklore often associated tuberculosis with vampires. When one member of a family died from it, the other infected members would lose their health slowly. People believe this was caused by the original person with TB draining the life from the other family members. And I just thought I'd just throw that in there. And John Keats, a poet, which has already been mentioned in this actually Caliban mentioned him, he died of consumption. A lot of people died of consumption. So that's all I'm going to mention there for now. Regarding that, I may bring up again later, because I'm sure it's going to need to in regards to.
You printed out a whole book, didn't you?
I did. Seems a crime that I'm not mentioning more, but I shall save it for later. All right. Anything else you want to say?
Yes. Okay. I just want to say thanks to the Lady Door for the 5-star review. Much appreciated. And thanks to Hot Tub for getting back in contact with us.
Hot Tub. Full of water.
Look it up on YouTube. It'll make it funny.
Yes. All right. See you next time.
Good night.
Oh, I'm your host, Em.
And I'm your host, Steve.
See you next time. This was a No Ship Network podcast brought to you by Axolotl Tank Productions.
Mother, tell your children not to walk my way. Tell your children not to hear my words, what they mean, what they say. Mother, mother, can you keep them in the dark for life?